get into one of these groups, there's only a couple ways you can get out. One is death. The other is mental institutions.
One, there's the idea when you said about Philip K. Dick and the Piscean Age. Well, so Philip K. Dick has his experience when he looks into the fish necklace, right? This woman is wearing a necklace with the early Christian fish symbol.
Right.
Well, in the UFO world, the aliens from Sirius, the Dogon, which of course is dog. But it's right. Also that they are fish people. So he
right.
looks into the fish symbol and gets this, you know, pink beam. You also have the idea of the Piscean Age, the symbol for Pisces being two fish. So it's sort of like that fish, that Christ figure being split into two. Now it's two fish. But Jesus himself actually...
one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, exactly. Now, my other thing I'm considering here is that, Philip K. Dick takes this in a very sort of Christian direction, but if you look at the constellations, you mentioned the constellation of Sirius and Lepus, which is the dog and the rabbit. Well, just, for lack of a better term, below that is the constellation Columbia, the dove. So if you were to get a transmission from Sirius coming down... it would almost sort of have to pass through the dove.
And the rabbit, yeah.
And now I'm picturing the OTO symbol, which has the dove, the descending spirit of the dove coming down.
Right.
Now this maybe is a good way to then jump into that direction of the beast. You know, when you say, what is the Luciferian angle? Is it really evil? Is it a necessary wisdom? And I just want to point out that just as the lightning flash coming down the tree is the descent of spirit into matter, when you said the upright pentagram, the spirit going up, this is what David was talking about earlier, the cathartic approach of ascending the tree. They call that the serpent of wisdom. To go up
right.
the tree is the serpent of wisdom. So I personally have come to the thing of that I think it's necessary to go up and down. It's sort of like...
No, that's not... just to clarify, it's not that the serpent of wisdom is necessarily the clephotic. The clepo is while ascending the tree, it mirrors things so that you feel that you're going, like... It's another path up the tree. So, like, oftentimes the serpent of wisdom is actually the proper pathway. The idea would be if you were looking at the tree in a mirror and were trying to work with it that way, you'd be doing the opposite thing. That's why
right.
I was relating it to pull spinning off into space and dying, is because he's taking an alternative pathway. So it's not like which doesn't mean that he's going the path of the serpent or something. It just means that there's two serpents, you know?
Right. It's like walking into a glass door or an elevator shaft or something. It's like you think you're going direction.
This is the veiled meaning, I think, of the caduceus of Hermes.
Yes.
Is that you have both paths are ascending the pole, and that's, yeah, there are two sides. It's yud-hey, vav-hey, forwards and backwards.
Right.
I think someone did a thing with The Shining like that.
Yeah, I think so. I want to drop some stuff that I've been waiting on here for a bit that was blowing my mind. Quite a while ago, Kevin, when you were talking about 23, and I thought you were going to go in this direction with it, but you're talking about the reverse, right? You were saying the W... And I thought you were just going to say that you have the 32 pathways and that the reverse of 32 pathways is 23, which
right.
is how I've been interpreting the 23 thing. for quite a while. But when you look at okay, how did I get to this? So the so the hieroglyph for the risen sun god Horus is a mirrored double K. So which in Semitic language would be it's the Ze. So like I don't know if that's Greek or what it is, but basically what appears as the letter Ze is actually derived from Shin mirrored against itself, which is actually what is the agreed assessment of where that letter came from. So that it's like an X with a line through it,
right?
And this comes up a lot where you see this double K thing over and over and over again in relationship to the Two Towers and Mario Brothers and in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. You know, you have this idea of the portal and the double K thing. But what blew my mind yesterday, I was trying to render this the gray and alien thing, and so I couldn't use my computer. And so I went out to my my den, so to speak. And I was watching, it just, this thing occurred to me, and I was like, I gotta try this. And so I had to use VHS and an LP, but I watched A Clockwork Orange with Supertramp's Breakfast in America, which is fucking incredible. Sounds orange, insane.
With Liberty offering the orange juice.
Thing. It keeps on going and going and going. There's so many things. This is like a synchronicity goldmine. And so if you look at the cover of Supertramp, you know, you can see the obvious, not so obvious prior to 9/11, but after 9/11, you look at those two towers and you see a mirrored 9/11 with the U and the P of Supertramp. Here, let me, I'll send it to you.
There's something that we've discussed this album cover many times, but a lot of people have not pointed out is on the back of the album cover there is a small little icon of a airplane going by the barcode, and if you look it actually shows the plane pointed right at the number 93, which you have of course flight 93 or 93 being that lightning flash. If anyone's going to look for that album cover, look at also for the back side of that album cover and look, I think it's in the bottom right hand corner, there's a little airplane pointed at the number 93.
So exactly. And so if you look at the back of the album cover as well, you'll see that there's two Kellogg's containers at the table. And one is just a large K and the other one says Kellogg's Corn Flakes. And so also you can see a veiled double K in the back as well. If you notice that what they're expressing throughout the album lyrically, there's continual references to time change. So you're looking from the view of an airplane at New York City, and she's holding orange juice in front of the two towers. And so there's this whole notion of it's breakfast in America. What time is it in the UK? So they're like, there's the if you open up the album of the LP, the song Breakfast in America has, you know, could we have kippers for breakfast? Mummy dear, they can have them in Texas because everyone's a millionaire. But in other words, you can eat breakfast in one place, you'd be having dinner in another. Clockwork Orange is in the UK, starts out with him drinking that tall glass of milk. The evenings are the good times for you, aren't they, Alex? Like, Alex has his evenings. This is all about breakfast. So what's happening in one place is happening in another. And so that's just one example, but the like I'm telling you, there's crazy synchronicity between these two things.
That's I gotta see this because just so, yesterday I heard a Supertramp song on the radio and my mind wanders to all the huge sync matrix surrounding that album, so perfect timing on that one.
I've been tripping on this album for quite a while, and after the fact, I'm like, how did this not fucking occur to me? Because you can see it in retrospect so apparently, because like, I posted this picture to you guys where I go through just some of these connections here, and like, you know, VW obviously equals, you know, va va va, which is 666, which is the sun, and A Clockwork Orange, we take it as that the sun moving through space, it's in its retrograde motion, which is the meaning of like the scarab pushing it, you know, it's because it's in retrograde, and a scarab pushes a dung ball backwards, right? But that, you know, you have all this whole thing with like the winged beetle and whatnot, like playing around with some of these ideas But one of the more interesting ones that, you know, I'm connecting Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which gets its title from the Alexander Pope quote, where it says, "How happy is the blameless vessel's lot, the world forgetting by the world forgot, eternal sunshine of the spotless mind, each prayer accepted and each wish resigned." Alexander Pope, Alexander DeLarge in A Clockwork Orange, and then Alexander Supertramp in fucking Into the Wild has no longer to be prisoned by civilization. He flees and walks alone upon the land to become lost in the wild. And it's like the wild beast, right? Being the beast is the Babylonian sun square, right? Where if you watch A Clockwork Orange, see where the policemen who take him to the water where they baptize him, the two are, one is 665, the other is 667. He's in between them. It's the only time in the entire film you see the sun as the sun is setting, and it's right there in between Alex. So between the two guys, you have Alex, and then he's in line with the sun. He's 666. It's as if Kubrick is like, 666, the sun, get it? Like A Clockwork Orange, get it? Like,
just to throw something in there, Aleister Crowley claimed the Aeon of Horus was the time of a warrior god who was going to come to avenge the conflicts of the binary system set place before that. So just the ultra violence, Alex as the middle being the sun. Just that interesting connection between like ultra violence and the vengeance of the warrior lord kind of thing, you know.
Totally. Yeah. But
please go on.
It's just so loaded, because then you have like Supertramp did Crime of the Century, right? Where you have the Superman 2 prison, where the people get put into a monolith, the three prisoners get put into a monolith, sent out into space in Superman 2. I don't know when the last time you guys have seen Superman 2 was, but that's like the Supertramp album cover. And then when Supertramp did like their greatest hits album, they have the orange juice coming up through the bars. And you have, you know, Alex goes through his Trading Places cycle where it's all about karma, where he's, you know, having his go at the public, and then the public has their go at him. And if you read the last chapter of the book, then he gets back at them all over again. But just that whole idea. But the fact that Supertramp is like Crime of the Century, and then has the two towers with the orange juice with the 9/11, like, that's, I've gone over this before, but that's a total mind fuck. Also, like Little Miss Sunshine, it centers around this like yellow Volkswagen bus, and then you have, like, you know, Aleister Crowley in court, when they ask him about 666, the beast, as a title, and he says, "Oh, it just means little sunshine." Or no, he says, "It means sun, means the sun. You can just call me little sunshine or little sun,"
right?
Or whatever. I think he called it sunshine. I think it's actually what he said. But then you have obviously the beetle on the beginning of The Shining, moving on, going to the sun road, yellow beetle, Volkswagen, VV, blah, 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 666. Like, it's just, yeah. But I love
it's awesome. I was eating an orange the whole time. You were mentioning orange juice and all that and sunshine. It's funny.
By coincidence, huh? By synchronicity. That's awesome. I love how in Into the Wild, you can see the bus that he ends up dying at within 142 side. It's pretty classic. Kind of.
Yeah, that book was really big for me, and it was like, it took a long time for me to actually catch that 142 on the bus. So like, it was another one of those sinks where I was into that book when I was very young and like totally unaware of this stuff. And then full circle, like my favorite book has the 42 on it. No longer my favorite book, but definitely a great book.
And just, you know, tying it back, you said, okay, so that was the thing, is that W is a 23rd letter of the alphabet. The hieroglyph for what it's a double hieroglyph. It means land of the spirits, and also means the risen sun god of Horus, is literally Shin mirrored against itself. isn't that fucking, oh man, I'm sorry, I'm trying to process all of that there, but a lot, but oh yeah, I don't even know where I'm completely going with that. I think it's interesting that in Batman, he's the Tim Burton one at the beginning when they're liking him. Yeah, I know. Did they name the royal baby? What did they name the royal baby?
George Alexander.
Did they? Oh, weird. Scary. that's like right at the same time where I'm tripping out on Alexander DeLarge and all of this stuff.
Is everyone freaking out that they're naming the baby after George Bush or no?
Is it really after George Bush? Because,
well, I mean, wouldn't the conspiracy dudes like go right after that immediately?
So King George, Eggman. Batman is likened to a vampire, right? You can see Wayne Enterprises is got this large W that they move towards in the new Batman, and see that it's all around the W, which is the 23. But now you're making this connection to Shin and the Judgment Card. And isn't it interesting then that they're liking him to a vampire while the pictograph related to Shin is a fang?
Oh, wow.
The canine tooth as well is the fang. And so, yeah, that's something I've spun around with quite a bit actually for a while now, is the idea of mastication, to break things down in order to integrate them, and how that relates to judgment. Kind of interesting.
Yeah, and also that interesting connection between the Dog Star as Anubis as well, who mummifies the dead, you know, and prepares the earthly vessel for the transition to the next world. So just like another interesting dog transformation kind of thing going there, you know.
Yeah. Have you seen what happens when you overlay the moon card and the sun card in Crowley's deck?
Oh no, why haven't I done that? That sounds awesome.
Let me show you. It'll just take me a second. But yeah, there's I went through a bunch of cards and I had some fun with that for a while, just seeing what would happen. And that one was my favorite, but there's something very peculiar about it that if you look at in the rider deck where the you know, you have the crustacean coming up, emerging from the water, the Piscinian waters, you have it's a crab, right? Essentially, even though it looks like a crawdad, it's, you know. Isn't it interesting that at the bottom of the sun card, you have this full zodiac and Crowley sun card represented, and at the very bottom, you have Cancer as the crustacean, and the beetle actually goes right to it in the center. If you can see what I'm looking at here. I don't know.
That's great.
So that feels... That's what makes it feel intentional to me.
Yeah, that would make great sense, you know, because... you might have even mentioned, you know, the moon card is the Pisces card, and I believe the moon is exalted in Cancer, so that would bring you back to Cancer, the crab, and the chariot of light, and again, the starry nature, you know?
Yeah, it's like that's why he wanted there, and it's like everything under the sun is in tune, but the sun is eclipsed by the moon because of the demuning process and it pulling the tides, and that we're never actually, we can't find with the moon, we can't be in the present because there's a constant never quite arrive. That's like you run to catch up with the sun, but it's sinking, racing around, it'll come up behind you again. Mm-hmm. Our emotional state is like dictated by the tides. So
right. That's awesome.
I need to point out here that something I'm working on playing with an image here for the show, and the combination of the 2001 projector and the Sirius star and looking at all the constellations and stuff. And what I realized is that opening shot of 2001 has, you know, the sun, the earth, and the moon. It's just, that's what sparked it for me. But it's important for me to point out that the rabbit, for the Japanese people, the rabbit is associated with the moon. Like the moon, they have this like folktale of a rabbit on the moon and all this sort of stuff. So right. When here we have, if Sirius is the spiritual sun and the rabbit is the sort of spiritual moon, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that would, totally. That would fit great, yeah.
Rabbit at the sun.
Right. And if you think about the, you know, the, like you said, Sirius being the source and it, you know, the information and coming through the white rabbit, that would kind of, I guess it would like kind of characterize the white rabbit as vessel or membrane for the information coming from Sirius or something, you know? So, and then that perfectly associates the white rabbit with the function of the holy guardian angel or the prince in the Thelemic and Kabbalistic mythos and philosophy. So then the rabbit is like the initiator into the mysteries or the holy guardian angel, the mysteries being the starry nature and such. So the moon rabbit as the vessel receiving the light from the two suns would make a lot of good sense.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's definitely definitely some sort of marriage there of the two principles.
I was off to pee, but I have to say this real quickly. So I watched a dumb movie called Family Weekend for synchronicity purposes only, just because I see Matthew Modine is in it, and. As soon as we started talking, we were introducing this idea of the membrane. And so I'm like, Matthew Modine, he's the private joker, right? And so like I watched Gross Anatomy, you know, it was just completely loaded with synchronicity. But in this film, Family Weekend, he's an artist and he keeps, there's a theme throughout the movie where he's saying he needs his space and he refers to his space as his membrane. And the family has with private joker's membrane, and like, and there's a point in the film where he finally concedes and he's like, okay, well I guess I could thin the membrane a little bit.
That is awesome.
Thought you'd like that.
That's great. Yeah, I had a one more Philip K. Dick thought that I wanted to throw out there that was really interesting. Oh yes. Okay. So yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know if I'm like going on and off track, but, I just, knowing that we were going to talk about Sirius last night, I threw together a lot of notes trying to kind of connect the Philip K. Dick, Alice Bailey, Robert Anton Wilson, you know, reception of the sync beams from Sirius. The interesting thing that I was catching about Philip K. Dick was that in his exegesis, he writes that pure information is being beamed from Sirius in a form that cannot be understood by the intellectual mind of man. Our plasma, on the other hand, or our plasmate nature, which is beyond mind, can get the data from that prime source and see through the kind of illusions of time and mental separation in the world. So Philip K. Dick, if you go through his exegesis, I wish I would have wrote down at what point he cuts into that, but he basically, I think, was talking about how to read sync, or how to, he said that, you know, the language of the unbroken language from the other side or Sirius is spoken in the trees and the wind and all this stuff. And to me, it really seems like he's pointing at like sync vision or some kind of you know, state of gnosis that goes beyond thought. And he even goes so far as to say in one point that we've lost our connection to this neutral voice in the silence of our own mind. And the amazing thing about that to me is it ties greatly back into the Thelemic, composition of the self, where the speech of the inner child or the holy guardian angel is known as the speech in the silence. And again, if the child and the holy guardian angel are the middle principle on the middle pillar, that is the neutral voice that Philip K. Dick was talking about. So I don't know. I'm getting tripped out here now as well. Just thinking about this, these beams of information and these characters opening themselves up like that.
Bill, I'm curious to hear you come in here because you've spent the last few weeks you did two co-hosting jobs on 42 Minutes talking about Philip K. Dick. You even got to speak to Philip K. Dick's wife. And you just did a Vinnie Eastwood show this week where you talked about the Holy Guardian Angel. I'm curious, where do you come in on some of this stuff?
Well, I think Kevin's right there where he's spotlighting a very key thing in Philip K. Dick that is that he's reading a language of the universe that is accessible with eyes wide open, right? And I think this is best illustrated in its most elementary and simple form as the alphabet soup. So he writes Radio Free Albemuth and he scraps it because he doesn't like it, right? And this is in 76. And then he spends all of 76, 77, 78, 79 tossing and turning all these ideas and trying to find a better way to communicate what he wants to communicate. And one of the things that he talks about is, you know, people have different relationships to whatever Valis is, right? And I won't get too complicated in this because Valis is really zebra. Valis is an extension of zebra, and it's trying to communicate this complex division between what the difference between zebra and Valis is. But to not get into that, he talks about different characters' relationships to the zebra-Valis construct, right? And one of the characters only knows it in theory, right? Does not have any direct experience with it. So I think you have that whole population of people who know what synchronicity is and know what coincidence is, but they're not having a direct experience with it in their life that's impacting them, that's creating this living mystery, right? Well, he talks about other characters who have this direct experience, and one of the ways he would express this direct experience is having a bowl of alphabet soup and looking down and having the letters spell out something very specific, something that could not have been done on purpose by the soup eater.
Right.
And you could not say that, is there a Russian technology that's beaming magnetic waves into my soup to spell out a message? That's pretty far out there. But it doesn't really matter because there's this felt experience of, you know, McKenna talks about the felt experience of the immediate moment, right? It's that membrane, that very precious, thin, delicate membrane of the all-encompassing now that when you look down into your alphabet soup and it says, hey, Bill, how you doing? There is a transfer of energy. There's a radiation there that compels you to figure out what is the power of this moment and why does it happen in smaller degrees and larger degrees and what is it saying? And this is, you know, this is your rabbit hole. This is your chase. This is your mystery. And you have to go and try to figure out why does this, the radiation of that moment, compel me into action.
Robert Anton Wilson talks about the same thing. He's talking about the movie Harvey, when the guy looks up in the dictionary the definition of the word puka. He's trying to find out what the puka is. And as he reads about it, it says, a puka is blah, blah, blah. And then it says, and how are you today, Mr. Wilson?
Right.
There you go.
And the guy's like looking in the dictionary, and suddenly there's a message in the dictionary waiting for him. And Robert Anton Wilson has the secondhand experience. So there's the character in the movie who has the alphabet soup moment, but Robert Anton Wilson, as another Wilson, has a secondhand version of that at the same time.
Right, right.
You know, Philip K. Dick writes that he goes, we are living within a giant teaching machine that we are no longer able to perceive. And he had to really admit to himself that, well, it was difficult for him to admit that John Calvin communicated this way back when, because he wasn't a Calvinist and he didn't necessarily follow with that branch of Christianity. But he's like, John Calvin said it more eloquently than me hundreds of years ago when I don't have the exact quote, but it boiled down is that we have natural talents that are corrupted, right? But we have supernatural talents that we're completely deprived of. And so this sensory awareness of sync is either the uncorruption of our natural talents or it's the rebirth of supernatural talents. And this was either an evolutionary thing that was happening, this was either a conspiracy thing happening, this is a chemical thing. You know, the genius of Philip K. Dick was to take 360 degrees of perspective and attack this mystery from so many different viewpoints. And maybe the sublimation of his schizophrenia was his ability to truly experience these as unique personalities. You know, that Philip K. Dick was a thousand-eyed human being. And he was able to enter into different pair of eyes every night and approach this from a different, not just from an intellectual, but from an actual complete
felt experience.
And
wow.
And so he was just hammering away. And so instead of getting seduced by one answer, because he knew that that was the temptation of the Christ, was to have the answer, to know the answer, but to deny that the Holy Spirit, you know, announces itself as a multi-sensory, multilinguistic, all-pervading, all-evolving thing. It's amazing that he only tried to kill himself like one or two times. Because I mean, the fact that he lived as long as he did is just, I mean, the every night this guy descended into the paranoia machine, you know, but willingly just diving into it. And if he had had a sync community, I don't know how it would have affected his work. I know he would have been a happier human being. Let's just say that.
Right. He might not have been able to go as deep because sometimes as we've discussed, you really need the dark night of the soul. It's like sometimes you need that solitary descent into madness.
It's the movie theater. You need the darkness to project the film on the membrane, or something like that.
So I have two quick things I want to sort of do here. One is a kind of joke, but it's more than a joke, as any good joke is. It's not a good joke, but you get what I'm saying. There's a hidden truth here in a sinky way. Is you mentioned Calvin, and I can't help but think of Calvin and Hobbes as the boy with the tiger. And David was talking earlier about Life of Pi, which has a boy and a tiger on a boat. So I can't help but now think of that movie in terms of Calvin and Hobbes.
Wow.
The other thing is Kevin, you put something on Facebook this week, which was about Philip K. Dick saying that he was channeling the spirit of a Kabbalist, like a 15th century Kabbalist.
Right.
That he would allow to take over his body and write through him.
Yeah, yeah.
What? Where did that come from? I've never...
Apparently, I mean, I know the exegesis is a rather fat book, and I certainly haven't given it my full attention, but I believe it's an excerpt of a letter he sent to, I can't remember who right now, I could try to pull it up, but
I read
basically,
that exact
same quote, Kev. Right, right.
Is this the collected letters, or this is...
I believe it's from Exegesis. I think it's even from Philip K. Dick's Exegesis Facebook page that I shared that. I'm looking at my Facebook right now to go back to it. But, you know, something interesting there again, Philip K. Dick lining up with Robert Anton Wilson and Aleister Crowley on this. Robert Anton Wilson at one time was told he was channeling a Chinese bard and like a Celtic priest or something of the matter like that. And so Philip K. Dick believes he's sharing a mind with a medieval Kabbalist. And then you've got Aleister Crowley, who claimed that he was a Theban priest, Ankh af Nakhonsu. And so it's amazing that all these people are channeling this information, and they claim that they are doing so from like a trans time, you know, shared mind kind of thing, you know? So it's a real theme with this stuff. let's see.
Well, I think, so I really think that this taps into this ability to take on a personality. Like, it's, if there's a ladder to intellectual and cognitive journeys, right? When you get to a certain like tributary of thought that was maybe opened up by an individual, it might be possible, and Philip K. Dick writes about this, that the DNA conserves sort of the imprint of the individual who breaks open that stream. Right. So like the mouse that, you know, the generation of mice that run the race, the maze, in a certain amount of time, the next generation that on average runs the maze faster, they've tapped in to the imprint in the DNA that the previous generation broke down for them. But maybe in human beings, when you find yourself in those kind of high-level cognitive streams, that there's an ability to put on the imprint like clothes or a mask, and to actually convince yourself just by the fact that the experience tells you this is what it is, that you can sort of tap into these chemical or DNA-based imprint zones, you know?
This was the thing I've been meditating on, is the idea that the media, you know, they say ghosts are sort of like a imprint or echo, a sort of psychic imprint, and that's what that spirit is. It's not necessarily that it still has consciousness or anything, but there's sort of a weird imprint of it left over. And media would be the exact same thing. As you recorded this moment in time, and now you can, that imprint can continue to echo. So we can go and read the book of this 17th century poet or this 11th century Chinese philosopher or whatever, or these guys are doing it without the media, without like reading their book, which reading someone's book is a sense of time travel. You're getting into that guy's head from that time, but this is doing the same thing without the media involved. And what is media but a medium, right? A medium, right, is someone who contacts spirits. So you, the whole thing is very loaded in that sense. And I think, Bill, you're right on point in a weird sort of way, is that this is doing the same thing, that only you're cutting out the middleman.
And this is kind of a funny little maybe nugget of evidence in that direction, is in reading all these letters of Philip K. Dick in his later life, you know, 77 through 82, I found that his voice in those letters kind of echoes certain personality traits of Mark LeClaire, who's, you know, an incredibly gifted writer. And it just, there would be turns of phrase and different things that he would write, because not all the letters are serious. Some of them are, you know, just letters to the cable company or what have you. But I'm reading this one letter by Philip K. Dick talking about how he just got Select TV, his new cable, so he could watch movies at home. And he's really diving into movies because Blade Runner is being produced, and he wants to know more about modern motion pictures. And so whenever he's given the chance to throw his two cents in, he can have a better appreciation for modern cinema. And he remarks that after, you know, a year of having this cable service, he has to say that his favorite movie out of all the ones he's seen is Phantom of the Paradise. Now, this is a film that I didn't know existed until Mark LeClaire wrote one of the most amazing film deconstructions that you'll ever find about any movie ever. And, you know, this is a movie that LeClaire saw when he was 13 years old in 1979. There's no way he would have known that this would have been, like, the one movie out of I don't know how many movies Philip K. Dick would have watched on cable, but he was kind of a homebody. So just to have that sort of immediate resonance in, you know, I don't know, it just kind of blew my mind how close that was.
A weird movie.
And what is a phantom but a spirit? So it's like the imprint of heaven. So which is what Philip K. Dick was sort of tapping into.
See, right. I the Phantom Menace is like if there was anything more like what's the subtext of the Star Wars films in the first place? They had a very deep subtext, but the way that he's relating to false flag terrorism in the same way that 2001 Space Odyssey is, he doesn't approach it from, he's like, fuck this, like, outside in kind of thing. He just like recognizes here are the archetypes and here's how manipulations take place and that there's a deeper reality in the midst and everything. I think the new Star Wars films actually have a huge value if you look at them through that lens. And the fact that they're as cheesy and fake as they are actually, for me, feels more and more like it just adds to it because it's like media. You're like watching, you're like, they don't like, it's like more of a plain picture in that way. I don't know. I kind of jumped subjects a little bit, but not really.
I think something interesting, you know, to tap back, like you're saying too, into the stream of the idea of the TV being a medium of between the spiritual world and such. When you think about what the Akashic Records are said to be, is basically like a vibrational imprint of, you know, the Earth's goings on, you know. So when you think about what we're doing with media right now, we're kind of doing an as above, so below sort of thing, where if the Akashic Records do exist on the astral membrane, then we're kind of building with like YouTube and cinema, like an Akashic record of like human history and like the drama of everything. So, you know, I definitely feel that there are the spiritual forces that narrate our lives in real time. I think they also do serve and communicate with us when they are captured in the Akashic record of the film membrane, you know?
Absolutely. Now, so think of it. This is what the internet at this point is, a material version of the Akashic records, right? It's a sort of, for lack of a better term, it's a sort of physicality or truly manifested physical version of it. I've thought, when I ponder this on the literal level, I think about, you know, the ideas of whether it be ancient astronauts or advanced civilizations of the past and things like that. You know, if let's go fast forward in time of 3,000 years, let's say there was an atomic war or whatever the fuck it is, right? Some electromagnetic pulse blows out all our communication systems and blah, blah, blah. Well, what would you have but history books full of, we used to be able to connect to these things. We used to be able to hear the voices of all the other people. Things that would sound mystical or magical, and that there would be a remnant of this information perhaps somewhere that we just couldn't tap into. And when you think about the idea of a philosopher's stone or a computer being made up of essentially quartz and crystals and et cetera, that we essentially use stones to speak to other people or other souls, other spirits. And you know, if you at some point lost this ability and trying to reclaim this ability, it's a whole rabbit hole in itself. But there are times when I think about this, that you could have a literal version of this either in the past or in the future, where we're having to try and remember, how did we do this? And you can do it through the route of technology, or you can do it, again, cutting out the middleman, going straight to the authentic Akashic records or unmanifested Akashic records.
Totally.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's right on. Yeah, I think it's also funny that, you know, when you kind of like lay out like something I kind of find fun to do with Sync is like to kind of like jumble keywords into like boxes and then like find the counterparts for those keywords or something. So, you know, I just thought of how, you know, we're talking about the film membrane and the screen as a astral menstruum for information. What do we use to you know, what do we call the act of putting that information upon that membrane? We call it a projector, you know, so that immediately invokes astral projection. And so, yeah, there's just like that idea of that dark, empty womb for which we can project that which we are trying to remember in a way, you know. And I think that's the funny thing, man. Like, you know, I used to never really be quite into like media. And I mean, for all intents and purposes, I could generally do without pop culture if it came down to it, you know, whatever. But like, in the long run, it's I've come to see it as a really amazing, complex manifestation of evolution and stuff. So I think it's crazy, but like every ounce of what we end up putting through these things is like part of this really epic, epic process. And like, even though there's bad movies and there's these films with propaganda and all this stuff, like, I think it's just like the human mind. Like, the human mind can be full of crap from time to time and like whatever, but for the most part, it's doing a great job of like moving forward and also remembering the past, you know? So I think, the screen is definitely, for better or worse, a big part of, returning to the whole in some way. It's not the only way, but it's, you know, it just appears to me that this, the attention that we give to this medium is, I think it's, you know, it's more than entertainment. And I think it's got a little bit more to do with evolution and, growth and that kind of stuff. You know, I just wanted to toss that in there because, you know, we're talking so much about all this stuff. But yeah, it serves a lot of means, you know, I think.
Well, I think that pop culture really reflects kind of, you know, Gurdjieff talks about the human diet and that just as much as the human being digests food, it digests thoughts, right? And so when you're watching media, you're digesting these thought forms. And pop culture kind of reflects the popular foods that we have. So fast food, processed food, that whole industry works on the same level as a street drug industry, where you can have a uncut key of Panamanian or I don't know where you get cocaine. But if you can divide that into like 14,000 different bags of cocaine, where each bag only has like 1% cocaine and you can still sell it, well then, you know, you can, that's the goal, because that's the bottom line. You want to make the most amount of money. So McDonald's, how much real food is in that meal? I don't know, but a hamburger 20 years ago for McDonald's cost $3. A hamburger today for McDonald's cost $3. I mean, like, it doesn't make any sense. So what we're getting in our films and our TV is the littlest amount of truth before we go, oh, that's bullshit, or that's unwatchable. There's just this little small amount that is enough to, you know, because people will say, oh, you know, you watch it with a bunch of people and you laugh at it. It's not like you're really receiving anything from it. You're just sort of using it to bullshit the time away. There's really no substance in what they're offering. So that when you do get hit with something like 2001, which is seemingly the uncut pure substance, you know, they overdose into boredom in 10 seconds because they can't, it just knocks them out. You know, they don't know how to process it anymore.
I'll say really quick, like I would somewhat agree, but I do think part of my like reconciling with media and stuff is that for me to watch something and enjoy it or to feel like it's serving a state of understanding, I think there's like a, it's kind of what you said. There's a bare minimum where it's like, it has to resonate with us for the most part, or else it would just, I mean, you know, they shoot movies at our animal nature, they shoot at our sexual nature. So there's different ways that we receive films, but I think for the most part, it's digestible. So as much as it's not superfood, I think there can be a decent source of Jungian appropriation of values from culture, and you know. But the thing is, that's where it gets subliminal. Subliminal is on a whole nother kind of level, you know, and that's the unfortunate layer of most films, is where they that's where they put the most potent things, it seems. But, you know, I just wanted to say, I do feel there's like a certain resonance that has to pass through the gates of acceptance or something, you know?
You know that idea that the pituitary and the pineal gland are generally like, it gets thrown around that the pineal is like atrophied in most people to a greater or lesser degree. But even more than just that aspect, but like the idea that, you know, like you don't have to think about your digestion in order to digest food. You don't have to think about your heartbeat in order for your heart to pump, but like you have to think about moving your hand in order for your hand to move. I forget there's a name for that, with the difference between it's been a while, but
yeah, like automatic and autonomic or something.
Yeah, the idea that your pineal gland is like that, where it's like for the most part in terms of the development, like it just does what it regulates. The melatonin and your pituitary regulates the serotonin, or not regulate, I guess your pituitary regulates your pineal gland just excretes or something. Anyways, but just this idea that you're going from something that would normally be on top of you or in control of you, like kind of a slave to it in a sense, or that you have dominion over it or you're able to direct it. I feel like that's the joke about film, is that you have these film directors, right? It's like they're directing this movie. Yet the observer is the observed, and the thinker is the thought. And so you can have a relationship with your perceptions that's like, you're not like, and this is kind of the joke also about like interpretation of films, because everyone can interpret it differently. Even if you read someone else's interpretation or hear someone else's interpretation, you're adapting your own perceptions of the thing in order to bring in this new idea. But like, this is the joke of like, people can't really own ideas. And it's so funny that this is like on people's minds right now, is like, oh, like idea rights and stuff. Cause it's like, you can't, it's like that whole notion is taking something from a realm where it doesn't even still ultimately have meaning, but it feels like it has more. Like if you go and you buy a television set and you set it up in your house, you're like, I own this, you know, this is mine. But like I watched last night, The Day the Earth Stood Still, the new one with Keanu Reeves. And he's like, you know, they're like, oh, this is our planet. And he's like, this is not your planet. It's like, is that what you think? This is your planet? Like, as if this was something that belonged to you. And I feel like film is that way too, because it's like nobody owns these ideas. No one owns this information, because this information is malleable. And the fact that it's malleable means it's not, it doesn't have a subject object relationship like we impress upon it, and that's all in our imagination.
Right, right.
And so I don't know, I feel that seems pretty applicable to me, that you could relate to the projection of the film in the same way that you could relate to the projections in your mind. Like the visuals that you're creating are largely due to the capacity of your pineal development. So dreams and whatnot, like the ability to like visualize. And so, and if you're bringing, the more you have that developed, the more that you bring that to the film, the more dominion you have upon what you're supposedly being impressed upon. Like you're being impressed by films, right? They're impressing these on you. Yet at the same time, it doesn't have to be that way. Like it just happens to be that way for most people, unfortunately, as far as I can tell.
Right. I think what was it, Crowley had a quote that was you know, in magic, in the world of magic, magic is a mirror. One who sees muck is muck, you know. So if you can exactly take that and point it toward the whole pop cultural thing as well, where it'd be really easy to see all the crap, because, you know, that might be what stands out the most. But to step aside the muck and see the communication of greater things, I think that's always there as well, you know, like no matter how bad something is, that's like just inherent in the human consciousness. I think it's a thing that Philip K. Dick, I think, called it luminous epinoia, which is like this kind of typifying quality of the human's imaginative liberty, you know. So we could imagine ourselves in a prison at any point in time, you know, or we could imagine ourselves in a free world at any point in time, no matter what the situation in general. And it imagination implies a certain liberation from the chains of mental certitude and stuff, you know. So that's the way I like to look at it, is in a way, you know, I mean, I think we should all spend a lot more time looking into our own black stones and meditating. And if it is that we want to communicate with these, you know, realms of information. But if not, I do think that the pop machine tends to reflect and trickle down some of the thresholds of present understanding. So there's definitely crap out there and all that kind of stuff. But I do think, like I said, there's this kind of there's a totality presented in the sum of our cinematic and artistic endeavors that outside of its intentions on a conscious level speaks volumes outside the world of good or bad and stuff like that, you know.
Totally.
But, you know, again, I'm not making excuses for all the crap, because I certainly find some movies really hard to stomach, and I just don't stomach them. I don't watch a lot of these military glorifying films. I don't enjoy them very much, but, you know, so I'm sure there's deep stuff in there too, but probably unintentional, you know.
Well, it's like, you know, McDonald's isn't the worst thing in the world if you eat it once a year. But right. If it's a steady diet of McDonald's, Wendy's, and Burger King, you know, there's something – you're going to pay the piper at the end of the day.
Right.
It's unavoidable.
I hear that, yeah. And I think that that's of the utmost importance is, yeah, staying connected with your own source, you know. That's yeah. For sure.
I like
that's, foremost.
the Holy Mountain Maru idea that the thing that's like to go and take the epitome of something that you're like, this is a worst case expression of this thing, and be able to transmute even that. It's like if you go, if it's, I mean, that's like what, ayahuasca is like. If you're like, well, if I can go, if you go this far to this extreme and you're able to bear and endure like this much, then it makes the whole continuum of everything after the fact that's like relatively along the spectrum feels more endurable, because exactly. you've so far with it. And so like I feel like even like taking something mundane and expressing something profound in it, like that that Matthew Modine thing I just watched called Family Weekend, and seeing something totally profound in it, actually at different points there's a few things, but like I'm like, this is shit. And literally there's there's the potential of transmutation into gold even there. So I don't know, I think there's something to be said for that.
We need a Burger King kill, right?
I like that.
We need Ronald McDonald to get hit right between the eyes by a pink laser beam and wake up a vegan and just throw out all the burgers and crap and just serve green smoothies out of those to-go windows.
Exactly, man. That's a something I've been thinking is that, you know, I think there's something called the it was a joke between a friend and I, but I call it the ill Leviathan, which is the idea that like the old world, I believe it's said in the Bible that at some point, you know, when evil is defeated, the people will build a tent in the skin of the Leviathan and feast on its flesh or something. And what I think about the future is that we will have the skeleton of this this capitalist, industrialist, materialist thing that has brought us all into positions of social responsibility and stratus and interrelations. And we'll leave that old Leviathan, but its bones will be left. It's the bones of our social interconnectivity and all this stuff is where we'll build, we'll put new flesh on those old bones, and it'll be the ill Leviathan, which ill in a good way, like something's illin', you know? And I really do feel like there is potential that like, as humans, as we get more in touch with our true nature, we won't be able, we'll find it a lot harder to accept allowing middlemen to block our connection to source. And I think what they will have to do is start adapting to our demand for prime source. So it's the same thing like the Green Revolution right now. Nobody wants artificially flavored apple candy so much anymore. People want an organic apple because they want a ground up connection to things. And I think corporations as they are already, PepsiCo, you know, trying to own the Naked juices, and they're already going out and all that. So it's like they're going to have to keep adjusting to our movement toward putting new flesh on the old bones of the Leviathan, I think. And I think some of this spiritual stuff and some of this consciousness, you know, we kind of, with Sync and all this stuff, we all really do encourage people to be at the wheel of their own bus. So I think even all of these mind games and these beyond mind games that we play are an important part of putting new meat on old bones, you know. And I think that includes like seeing some of the crappy old movies as somehow a reflection of deep truths and our nature, you know. So yeah, I look forward to the Ill Leviathan, you know.
In that scenario, does that make Ronald, the redheaded Ronald McDonald, the whore of Babylon?
That'd be awesome.
Well,
yeah,
Wendy's a redhead.
I thought Arch, like that was the whole deal. No, it's not.
I missed you there for a second.
Golden Arch. I thought that was the whole meaning of that. Was that okay? I thought that was a stone that the builders rejected. It was McDonald's, and now that it's succeeding, means I don't know. I see McDonald's the ultimate expression of the evil handmaiden, like it's the substitute replacement reality, and of course, like the fact that it's a cost that it's precipitating. Like, but at the same time, representing itself as this super like positive thing that's good for kids and all, like it's ancient, and it's like, you know, the company is little children. I really resonate with the idea that all of the corporations have their sigils are really just like, I mean, there's not there. It feels like there's nothing more directly Clifonic as that. Like that's like they're literally like evoking these different intelligences that are, you know, mechanical and life-sucking, you know, through, you know, sigil magic. And McDonald's seems to be like very primary one, along with like Starbucks or whatever, like but that, you know.
Okay, well, I have a question for you then, David, because the idea of the stone the builders rejected, you have Wendy. Bill just said that Wendy was actually the true redhead, but she's also an orphan, right? So she's the stone the builders rejected as well. Mm-hmm. But this idea of if their whole thing is sigil magic as this sort of cathartic thing, and then as Bill was expressing the desire to see the Burger King kill, and then instead you're giving out green smoothies at the drive-thru, is this a battle of magic then? Like we're trying to turn their corporate system and their almost like a Go board or the game Othello, where you're trying to flip all those fast food restaurants that dot the landscape from something from the dark side of the tree to the light side of the tree.
That's awesome.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
That's great. Because the installation of all these franchises, right? Like, that was the whole thing about churches, right? If you put a church in every town, right, and all the churches were connected via some sort of helping people matrix, well, then the goal would be over time, the whole planet, every town would have a church connected to each other. This would be your sort of your internet, right? The information would flow. You would know which towns were going through a drought, which towns were going through disaster, and all the funds would just trickle into the areas that needed it, right? So you have these franchises and these fast food restaurants. Well, just getting them up and built so that you have, you know, I don't know, 20,000 McDonald's around the world. Well, granted, it sucks that they sell poison right now, right? But you could, like you said, on a Go board, you could flip those, and in 1 year, they could be serving healthy food. And what went from, you know, this horrible machine serving poison could be the machine that heals and then stabilizes an entire planet.
So spice must flow.
I almost think we had to go through the odd trauma of capitalism or something so that we can get back to some greater collective cooperative mutual aid system. So like, yeah, like when I think of the corporate model having new flesh put on it, I mean, I totally imagine, you know, community owned, operated and benefiting things. You know what I mean? Like these things won't, they'll be barely a reflection of what they are right now. And of course I'm being idealistic and stuff here, but like, I really think that we had to realize that this doesn't work and then we need to put new flesh on those old bones in every way. And I mean, I'm already excited to see that the Occupy Wall Street movement, is beginning to create their own like credit union kind of thing. It's going to be a bank by the people for the people. I don't know. I haven't read much into it, so I'm not being a proponent or anything just yet. But I think we're going to start reimagining all this kind of stuff. And to tie it all right back into Sirius, it is the star that marks Independence Day, and it's a star that's really relative to the individual freedom and expression. So I think as we move into more and more resonance with the spiritual sun in that way, you'll notice all these rebellions that are going on. Like Egypt had a pretty great Sirius alignment, you know, not long ago, when there was a lot of people banding together and expressing themselves in new ways. And I know the Occupy movement had some Sirius alignment as well. So I think the rise of the ill Leviathan or whatever is connected to that.
Even the fact that the Occupy movement had its big thing on May Day, and a lot of the right-wing conspiracy people said this was proof that it was some sort of communist plot or something like that. But if you take this back to the Arthurian legends, King Arthur is told by Merlin, the child born on May 1st is destined to overthrow the king. So what he does is he commits this like mass genocide of every child born, and to try and prevent this from happening and blah blah blah. But this to me, the idea of May Day is hand in hand with the king kill in itself.
You do realize that the Occupy movement, that the first website that went up was directly from the Lucis Trust.
Is that right?
The Lucis initiated the Occupy. I read that and I was like, what the fuck? I don't know if this is the best representation of it that I just sent you a link to. I just looked up the first thing I could find, but it's straight up, like, you can, it's all cross-referenceable. It's just like on any website you can look up and see where the address. And so the address was first, it caught attention because they're like, what, the United Nations put up the fucking first Occupy Wall Street website, but then it actually turned out that the specific location within the United Nations was the Lucis Trust. So there's your serious Occupy connection.
Boom, boom, boom. I mean, yeah, and then of course, you know, the Eye of Horus being the symbol of the Freemasons, who many people associate with the French Revolution, the American Revolution, is often depicted as the star on the middle pillar. You'll see the Eye of Horus imposed over the blazing star, and not so much the sun. Some people think it's the eye imposed over the sun on the back of the dollar bill, but I'm pretty sure that the Masons very consistently use the eye in the pyramid as a symbol for Sirius. And on that note, it's very interesting that Robert Anton Wilson is a huge guy who inserted awareness of that logo and that of this culture of awareness of these things into everything. So, you know, well, it's just, we got a symbol for Sirius in our pocket every day as we relate to an empire built on rebellion, founded on Sirius holidays and stuff.
Just to clarify, though, I believe there's Orion and Sirius are represented as Osiris and Isis. And so Orion is the hunter, right, next to the dog, which is Sirius. And so my understanding, then, so Osiris is related to Orion, which is the
correct. That is correct.
Okay,
but if you go to the hieroglyph for Sirius, it's generally a triangle, then a semicircle, and then the little six-pointed double K thing you mentioned. And I believe that they associate the obelisk with Osiris, the dome with Isis, and then the child of the two as Horus.
The star.
As the star.
The star child, yeah.
And Albert Pike definitely has some good stuff on how the middle pillar is typified by the child and the star Sirius. But at the same time, Sirius was the star of Isis for a greater portion of mysteries as well, you know.
Yeah, I went into the Synchronized I just put up a day or two ago. I talk about the Eye of Horus / Eye of Ra as Sirius, and that this is – so there are certain days, you know, all these sort of Sirius holidays like 4th of July. So obviously you have the Bavarian Illuminati being founded on May 1st, again, with the intent of overthrowing the patriarchs and the theocracies, so mm-hmm. them trying to overthrow, and then you have the founding of America on 4th of July also being a serious day. So absolutely, this is all very, very much connected.
Yeah. And yeah, it's a rather interesting narrative with, you know, I don't know. I have some thoughts about just the there's the idea in the three schools of magic and occultism that when the black school puts in work or sends out characters, that the white school responds in a similar fashion, and I really feel like a lot of this serious stuff has a lot to do with the white school getting back in, getting things rolling again. And I'm not trying to say that the Masons are a representation of the white school entirely, because I know they got their hands in some weird shit too. But the Sirius is held by Alice Bailey as the location of the Great White Lodge, where all the great teachers of mankind and you know, the spiritual nature of mankind is held. So I really do feel like there's a theme here with all this serious stuff, where it's like the white school.
This is the middle pillar, though, because ultimately this is what just watch the movie The Dark Crystal, right? It's like the black school is the white school. And so, yes, of course, for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. So if you do some, if there's a school that's trying to do something dastardly, there's a school that's trying to do something positive, and yet they're ultimately the same thing.
They're interdependent. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the weird thing is, like, with the whole Illuminati stuff, you know, it's like it's hard to see. It's really easy to see the dark sides of all of these orders and all this information, but then on the other hand, like, what if we mainly only hear about the crappy stuff and we focus in on all that, what is the white school doing? You know what I mean? Like, in what good is going on? And I think it's going on a lot of ways for people in terms of just reconnecting to mystery and joy and disconnecting from empire and stuff like that, I think is kind of part of it. And so yeah, it's easy to see the black school in action, but I find some of this, a lot of this sync stuff and a lot of these characters that we find trying to speak of these things, you know, it seems as if, like, they're a result of some attempt at communication from the white school or something, you know, I don't know. And I guess, like, it's weird. I guess I start to sound more and more just like the, I don't know, I've read these things before about, like, the meddlers and the white school and stuff, but The more I paint the pictures for myself, I do see correlations, you know.
Kevin, any parting thoughts?
Well, yeah. I guess if anyone listened to this and they liked what they heard, you could check me out on Vimeo. I made sync videos at IndraDinesh42. My blog is called Live from the Logosphere. I wish I got over there more often, but you could find some fun posts from over the years, as well as g8ors.blogspot.com, where I blog with some fun syncsters as well. And I guess, like, you know, my closing thoughts is, like, anyone who's listening to this stuff and, you know, finds all this occult stuff, like, weird and mysterious and all these things, like, I'm not, like, sharing any of this stuff to project any agenda. I'm not trying to turn anybody into Thelemites or any of that kind of stuff with my attention to Aleister Crowley and some of these things. But I just do find that sharing these things about our spiritual nature and enjoying the mystery of our relationship to all these things is self-empowering. And so, you know, take all of it with a grain of salt and, like, meditate on it all yourself. And, you know, I just find it fun and kind of liberating to connect these dots and create my own story and share the story you guys are co-creating as well and stuff here. So I just wanted to put out there that I got no agenda with what I have to say about this stuff. I just really love connecting the dots and following the white rabbit. And I look forward to our the remembering that I think that we're all doing right now. And I thank all you dudes and everybody out there and dudettes and everything for participating in this, like, awakening process, because it's rather enjoyable and cool. So cheers to you all.
Like, for instance, this drug I take, Depakote, the first thing that it supposedly deals with is mania. Well, I'm taking a drug for mania. I don't have mania. Do I? Did I? Would I? Should I? Will I? Could I? Do I want to? And so forth and so on. So.
You didn't feel like you had any bit of mania in you before?
At times I've been accused of mania, but by idiots.